This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Carve the Mark by Veronica Roth. Performed by Austin Butler and Emily Rankin. 1. Chapter 1. Akos. Hush flowers always bloomed when the night was longest. The whole city celebrated the day the bundle of petals peeled apart into rich red. Partly because hush flowers were the nation's lifeblood, and partly, Akos thought, to keep them all from going crazy in the cold. That evening, on the day of the blooming ritual, he was sweating into his coat as he waited for the rest of the family to be ready. So he went out to the courtyard to cool off. The Kariseth house was built in a circle around a furnace. All the outermost and innermost walls curved, for luck, supposedly. Frozen air stung his eyes when he opened the door. He yanked his goggles down, and the heat from his skin fogged up the glass right away. He fumbled for the metal poker with his gloved hand and stuck it under the furnace hood. The burnstones under it just looked like black lumps before friction lit them, and then they sparked in different colors, depending on what they were dusted with. The burnstones scraped together and lit up bright red as blood. They weren't out here to warm anything or light anything. They were just supposed to be a reminder of the current, as if the hum in Akos's body wasn't enough of a reminder. The current flowed through every living thing and showed itself in the sky in all different colors. Like the burnstones, like the lights of the floaters that zoomed overhead on their way to town proper. Off-worlders who thought their planet was blank with snow had never actually set foot on it. Akos's older brother, Ijah, poked his head out. "Eager to freeze, are you? Come on, Mom's nearly ready." It always took their mom longer to get ready when they were going to the temple. After all, she was the oracle. Everybody would be staring right at her. Akos put the poker down and stepped inside, popping the goggles off his eyes and pulling his face shield down to his throat. His dad and his older sister, Sisi, were standing by the front door, stuffed into their warmest coats. They were all made of the same material, kutia fur, which didn't take dye, so it was always white-gray and hooded. "All right then, Akos?" "Good." His mom was fastening her own coat closed. She eyed their dad's old boots. "Somewhere out there, your father's ashes are collectively shuddering at how dirty your shoes are, Asa." "I know. That's why I fussed about dirtying them up," their dad said with a grin at their mom.
"Good,"
she said. Almost chirped it, in fact. "I like them this way." "You like anything my father didn't like." "That's because he didn't like anything."
"Can we get into the floater while it's still warm?"
I just said. A little bit of a whine in his voice.
"Or he's waiting for us by the memorial."
Their mom finished with her coat and put on her face shield. Down the heated front walk they bobbed, all fur and goggle and mitten. A squat, round ship waited for them, hovering at knee height just above the snowbank. The door opened at their mom's touch and they piled in. Sisi and Ijah had to yank Akos in by both arms because he was too small to climb on his own. Nobody bothered with safety belts.
"To the temple!" their dad cried, his fist in the air.
He always said that when they went to the temple, sort of like cheering for a boring lecture or a long line on voting day. If only we could bottle that excitement and sell it to all of Thuva. Most of them I see just once a year. And then only because there's food and drink waiting for them. Their mom drawled with a faint smile.
"There's your solution then," Ijah said. "Entice them with food all season long."
"The wisdom of children," their mom said, poking the ignition button with her thumb. The floater jerked them up and forward, so they all fell into each other. Ijah punched Akos away from him, laughing. The lights of Hessa twinkled up ahead. Their city wrapped around a hill, the military base at the bottom, the temple at the top, and all the other buildings in between. The temple, where they were headed, was a big stone structure with a dome, made of hundreds of panes of colored glass, right in the middle of it. When the sun shone on it, Hess's peak glowed orange-red, which meant it almost never glowed. The floater eased up the hill, drifting over stony Hessa, as old as their nation planet. Thuva, as everyone but their enemies called it, a word so slippery off-worlders tended to choke on it. Half the narrow houses were buried in snowdrifts. Nearly all of them were empty. Everybody who was anybody was going to the temple tonight. "See anything interesting today?" their dad asked their mom as he steered the floater away from a particularly tall wind meter poking up into the sky. It was spinning in circles. Akos knew by the tone of his dad's voice that he was asking their mom about her visions. Every planet in the galaxy had three oracles, one rising, one sitting, like their mother, and one falling. Akos didn't quite understand what it meant, except that the current whispered the future in his mom's ears, and half the people they came across were in awe of her. "I may have spotted your sister the other day," the mom started. "Doubt she'd want to know, though." "She just feels the future ought to be handled with the appropriate respect for its weight." Their mom's eyes swept over Akos, Aija, and Sizi in turn. "This is what I get for marrying into a military family, I guess," she said eventually. "You want everything to be regulated, even my current gift." "You'll notice that I flew in the face of family expectation and chose to be a farmer, not a military captain," their dad said. "And my sister doesn't mean anything by it. She just gets nervous, that's all." "Hmm," their mom said, like that wasn't all. Sizi started humming, a melody Akos had heard before, but couldn't say from where. His sister was looking out the window, not paying attention to the bickering. And a few ticks later, his parents' bickering stopped, and the sound of her hum was all that was left. Sizi had a way about her, their dad liked to say, an ease. The temple was lit up, inside and out. Strings of lanterns, no bigger than Akos's fist, hanging over the arched entrance. There were floaters everywhere, strips of colored light wrapped around their fat bellies, parked in clusters on the hillside or swarming around the domed roof in search of a space to touch down. Their mom knew all the secret places around the temple, so she pointed their dad toward a shadowed nook next to the refectory, and led them in a sprint to a side door that she had to pry open with both hands. They went down a dark stone hallway, over rugs so worn you could see right through them, and past the low, candlelit memorial for the Thuvazites who had died in the Shotet invasion before Akos was born. He slowed to look at the flickering candles as he passed the memorial. Aija grabbed his shoulders from behind, making Akos gasp, startled. He blushed as soon as he realized who it was, and Aija poked his cheek, laughing. "I can tell how red you are, even in the dark." "Shut up," Akos said. "Aija," their mom chided, "don't tease." She had to say it all the time. Akos felt like he was always blushing about something. "It was just a joke." They found their way to the middle of the building, where a crowd had formed outside the Hall of Prophecy. Everyone was stomping their way out of their outer boots, shrugging off coats, fluffing hair that had been flattened by hoods, breathing warm air on frozen fingers. The Karasethes piled their coats, goggles, mittens, boots, and face coverings in a dark alcove, right under a purple window with a Thuvazite character for the current etched into it. Just as they were turning back to the Hall of Prophecy, Akos heard a familiar voice. "Aij, Ori Rednalis," Aij's best friend, came barreling down the hallway. She was gangly and clumsy-looking, all knees and elbows and stray hair. Akos had never seen her in a dress before, but she was in one now, made of heavy purple-red fabric and buttoned at the shoulder like a formal military uniform. Ori's knuckles were red with cold,
She jumped to a stop in front of Aija. There you are. I've had to listen to two of my aunt's rants about the assembly already, and I'm about to explode. Akos had heard one of Ori's aunt's rants before, about the assembly, the governing body of the galaxy, valuing Thuva only for its ice flower production, and downplaying the Shotet attacks, calling them civil disputes. She had a point, but Akos always felt squirmy around ranting adults. He never knew what to say. Ori continued, "Hello, Ausa, Sifa, Sizi, Akos, happy blooming. Come on, let's go, Aij." She said all this in one go, hardly taking the time to breathe. Aija looked to their dad, who flapped his hand. "Go on, then. We'll see you later. And if we catch you with a pipe in your mouth, as we did last year," their mom said, "we will make you eat what's inside it." Aija quirked his eyebrows. He never got embarrassed about anything, never flushed. Not even when the kids at school teased him for his voice, higher than most boys, or for being rich, not something that made a person popular here in Hesse. He didn't snap back, either, just had a gift for shutting things out and letting them back in only when he wanted to. He grabbed Akos by the elbow and pulled him after Ori. Sizi stayed behind with their parents, like always. Aija and Akos chased Ori's heels all the way into the Hall of Prophecy. Ori gasped. And when Akos saw inside the hall, he almost echoed her. Somebody had strung hundreds of lanterns, each one dusted with hush flower to make it red, from the apex of the dome down to the outermost walls, in every direction, so a canopy of light hung over them. Even Aija's teeth glowed red when he grinned at Akos. In the middle of the room, which was usually empty, was a sheet of ice about as wide as a man was tall. Growing inside it were dozens of closed-up hush flowers on the verge of blooming. More burnstone lanterns, about as big as Akos's thumb, lined the sheet of ice where the hush flowers waited to bloom. These glowed white, probably so everyone could see the hush flower's true color, a richer red than any lantern, as rich as blood, some said. There were a lot of people milling about, dressed in their finery, loose gowns that covered all but the hands and head, fastened with elaborate glass buttons in all different colors, knee-length waistcoats lined with supple Elta skin, and twice-wrapped scarves, all in dark, rich colors, anything but gray or white, in contrast to their coats. Akos's jacket was dark green, one of Aija's old ones, still too big in the shoulders for him, and Aija's was brown. Ori led the way straight to the food. Her sour-faced aunt was there, offering plates to passers-by. But she didn't look at Ori. Akos got the feeling Ori didn't like her aunt and uncle, which was why she pretty much lived at the Karaseth house, but he didn't know what had happened to her parents. Aija stuffed a roll in his mouth, practically choking on the crumbs. "Careful," Akos said to him. "Death by bread isn't a dignified way to go." "At least I'll die doing what I love," Aija said, around all the bread. Akos laughed. Ori hooked her elbow around Aija's neck, tugging his head in close. "Don't look now. Stairs coming in from the left." "So?" Aija said, spraying crumbs. But Akos already felt heat creeping into his neck. He chanced a look over at Aija's left. A little group of adults stood there, quiet, eyes following them. "You'd think you'd be a little more used to it, Akos," Aija said to him. "Happens all the time, after all." "You'd think they would be used to us," Akos said. "We've lived here all our lives. And we've had fates all our lives. What's there to stare at?" Everyone had a future, but not everyone had a fate. At least that was what their mom liked to say. Only parts of certain favored families got fates, witnessed at the moment of their births by every oracle on every planet, in unison. When those visions came, their mom said, they could wake her from a sound sleep. They were so forceful,
Aija, Sisi, and Akos had fates. Only they didn't know what they were, even though their mom was one of the people who had seen them. She always said she didn't need to tell them. The world would do it for her. The fates were supposed to determine the movements of the worlds. If Akos thought about that too long, he got nauseous. Ori shrugged. My aunt says the Assembly's been critical of the oracles on the news feed lately, so it's probably just on everyone's minds.
Critical? Akko said. Why?
Aija ignored them both. Come on, let's find a good spot. Ori brightened. Yeah, let's. I don't want to get stuck staring at other people's butts like last year. I think you've grown past butt height this year, Aija said. Now you're at mid-back, maybe.
Oh, good, because I definitely put on this dress for my aunt so I could stare at a bunch of backs.
Ori rolled her eyes. This time, Akos slipped into the crowd in the Hall of Prophecy first, ducking under glasses of wine and swooping gestures until he got to the front, right by the ice sheet and the closed-up hush flowers. They were right on time, too. Their mom was up by the ice sheet, and she had taken off her shoes, though it was chilly in here. She said she was better at being an oracle when she was closer to the ground. A few ticks ago, he'd been laughing with Aija, but as the crowd went quiet, everything in Akos went quiet too. Aija leaned in close to him and whispered in his ear, "Do you feel that? The current's humming like crazy in here. It's like my chest is vibrating." Akos hadn't noticed it, but Aija was right. He did feel like his chest was vibrating, like his blood was singing. Before he could answer, though, their mom started talking. Not loud, but she didn't have to be, because they all knew the words by heart. The current flows through every planet in the galaxy, giving us its light as a reminder of its power. As if on cue, they all looked up at the current stream, its light showing in the sky through the red glass of the dome. At this time of year, it was almost always dark red, just like the hush flowers, like the glass itself. The current stream was the visible sign of the current that flowed through all of them, and every living thing. It wound across the galaxy, binding all the planets together like beads on a single string. The current flows through everything that has life, Sifa went on, creating a space for it to thrive. The current flows through every person who breathes breath and emerges differently through each mind's sieve. The current flows through every flower that blooms in the ice. They scrunched together, not just Akos and Aija and Ori, but everyone in the whole room, standing shoulder to shoulder, so they could all see what was happening to the hush flowers in the ice sheet. The current flows through every flower that blooms in the ice, Sifa repeated, giving them the strength to bloom in the deepest dark. The current gives the most strength to the hush flower, our marker of time, our death-giving and peace-giving blossom. For a while there was silence, and it didn't feel odd, like it should have. It was as if they were all hum-buzz singing together, feeling the strange force that powered their universe, just like friction between particles powered the burnstones. And then, movement. A shifting petal, a creaking stem, a shudder went through the small field of hush flowers growing among them. No one made a sound. Akos glanced up at the red glass, the canopy of lanterns, just once, and he almost missed it. All the flowers bursting open, red petals unfurling all at once, showing their bright centers draping over their stems. The ice sheet teemed with color. Everyone gasped and applauded. Akos clapped with the rest of them until his palms itched. Their dad came up to take their mom's hands and plant a kiss on her. To everyone else, she was untouchable. Sifa Kereseth, the Oracle, the one whose current gift gave her visions of the future. But their dad was always touching her, pressing the tip of his finger into her dimple when she smiled, tucking strays back into the knot she wore her hair in, leaving yellow flower fingerprints on her shoulders when he was done kneading the bread. Their dad couldn't see the future, but he could mend things with his fingers, like broken plates or the crack in the wall screen or the frayed hem of an old shirt. Sometimes he made you feel like he could put people back together too, if they got themselves into trouble. So when he walked over to Akos, swung him into his arms, Akos didn't even get embarrassed. "Smallest child," his dad cried, tossing Akos over his shoulder.
"Oh, not so small, actually. I almost can't do this anymore."
"That's not because I'm big, it's because you're old," Akos replied.
"Such words from my own son," his dad said. "What punishment does a sharp tongue like that deserve, I wonder?"
"Don't!" But it was too late. His dad had already pitched him back and let him slide, so he was holding both of Akos's ankles. Hanging upside down, Akos pressed his shirt and jacket to his body, but he couldn't help laughing. Ausa lowered him down, only letting go when Akos was safe on the ground.
"Let that be a lesson to you about sass," his dad said, leaning over him.
"Sass causes all the blood to rush to your head?" Akos said, blinking innocently up at him.
"Precisely," Ausa grinned. "Happy blooming."
Akos returned the grin.
"You too."
That night, they all stayed up so late Aija and Ori both fell asleep upright at the kitchen table. Their mom carried Ori to the living room couch, where she spent a good half of her nights these days. And their dad roused Aija. Everybody went one way or another after that, except Akos and his mom. They were always the last two up. His mom switched the screen on, so the assembly news feed played at a murmur. There were 9 nation planets in the assembly, all the biggest or most important ones. Technically, each nation planet was independent, but the assembly regulated trade, weapons, treaties, and travel, and enforced the laws in unregulated space. The assembly feed went through one nation planet after another. Water shortage on Tepis, new medical innovation on Othir, pirates boarded a ship in Pitha's orbit. His mom was popping open cans of dried herbs. At first, Akos thought she was going to make a calming tonic to help them both rest. But then she went into the hall closet to get the jar of hush flower, stored on the top shelf, out of the way. "I thought we'd make tonight's lesson a special one," Sifa said. He thought of her that way, by her given name, and not as Mom, when she taught him about ice flowers. She'd taken to calling these late-night brewing sessions lessons as a joke 2 seasons ago, but now she sounded serious to Akos. Hard to say with a mom like his. "Get out a cutting board and cut some harva root for me," she said, and she pulled on a pair of gloves. "We've used hush flower before, right?"
"In sleeping elixir," Akos said, and he did as she said, standing on her left with cutting board and knife and dirt-dusted harva root. It was sickly white and covered in a fine layer of fuzz. "And that recreational concoction," she added. "I believe I told you it would be useful at parties someday. When you're older."
"You did," Akos said.
"You said when you're older, then too."
Her mouth slanted into her cheek. Most of the time, that was the best you could get out of his mom. "The same ingredients an older version of you might use for recreation, you can also use for poison," she said, looking grave. "As long as you double the hush flower and halve the harva root. Understand?"
"Why?"
Akos started to ask her, but she was already changing the subject.
"So,"
she said, as she tipped a hush flower petal onto her own cutting board. It was still red, but shriveled, about the length of her thumb.
What is keeping your mind busy tonight?
Nothing, Akko said. People staring at us at the blooming, maybe. They are so fascinated by the fate favored. I would love to tell you they will stop staring someday, she said with a sigh. But I'm afraid that you will always be stared at. He wanted to ask her about that pointed you, but he was careful around his mom during their lessons. Ask her the wrong question, and she ended the lesson all of a sudden. Ask the right one, and he could find out things he wasn't supposed to know. How about you? He asked her. What's keeping your mind busy? I mean, His mom's chopping was so smooth. The knife tap, tap, tapping on the board. His was getting better, though he still carved chunks where he didn't mean to. Tonight, I am plagued by thoughts about the family Noavec. Her feet were bare, toes curled under from the cold, the feet of an oracle. They are the ruling family of Shotet, she said, the land of our enemies. The Shotet were a people, not a nation planet, and they were known to be fierce, brutal. They stained lines into their arms for every life they had taken, and trained even their children in the art of war. And they lived on Thuva, the same planet as Akos and his family, though the Shotet didn't call this planet Thuva, or themselves Thuvazits, across a huge stretch of feathergrass. The same feathergrass that scratched at the windows of Akos's family's house. His grandmother, his dad's mom, had died in one of the Shotet invasions, armed only with a bread knife, or so his dad's stories said. And the city of Hessa still wore the scars of Shotet violence, the names of the lost carved into low stone walls, broken windows patched up instead of replaced, so you could still see the cracks. Just across the feathergrass. Sometimes they felt close enough to touch. The Noavec family is fate-favored. Did you know that? Just like you and your siblings are, Sifa went on. The oracles didn't always see fates in that family line. It happened only within my lifetime. And when it did, it gave the Noaveks leverage over the Shotet government to seize control, which has been in their hands ever since. I didn't know that could happen. A new family suddenly getting fates, I mean. Well, those of us who are gifted in seeing the future don't control who gets a fate, his mom said. We see hundreds of futures of possibilities. But a fate is something that happens to a particular person in every single version of the future we see, which is very rare. And those fates determine who the fate-favored families are, not the other way around. He'd never thought about it that way. People always talked about the oracles doling out fates like presents to special, important people. But to hear his mom tell it, that was all backward. Fates made certain families important. So you've seen their fates. The fates of the Noaveks. She nodded. Just the son and the daughter. Rizek and Syra. He's older. She's your age. He'd heard their names before, along with some ridiculous rumors. Stories about them frothing at the mouth or keeping enemies' eyeballs in jars, or lines of kill marks from wrist to shoulder. Maybe that one didn't sound so ridiculous. Sometimes it is easy to see why people become what they are, his mom said softly. Rizek and Syra, children of a tyrant. Their father, Lazmet, child of a woman who murdered her own brothers and sisters. The violence infects each generation. She bobbed her head, and her body went with it, rocking back and forth. And I see it. I see all of it. Akos grabbed her hand and held on. I'm sorry, Akos, she said. And he wasn't sure if she was saying sorry for saying too much or for something else. But it didn't really matter. They both stood there for a while, listening to the mutter of the news feed, the darkest night somehow even darker than before. Chapter 2, Akos.
Happened in the middle of the night, Osno said, puffing up his chest. I had this scrape on my knee, and it started burning. By the time I threw the blankets back, it was gone.
The classroom had one curved wall and two straight ones. A large furnace packed with burnstones stood in the center, and their teacher always paced around it as she taught, her boots squeaking on the floor. Sometimes Akos counted how many circles she made during one class. It was never a small number. Around the furnace were metal chairs with glass screens fixed in front of them at an angle, like tabletops. They glowed, ready to show the day's lesson. But their teacher wasn't there yet.
Show us then,
another classmate, Riha, said. She always wore scarves stitched with maps of Thuva, a true patriot, and she never trusted anyone at their word. When someone made a claim, she scrunched up her freckled nose until they proved it. Osno held a small pocket blade over his thumb and dug in. Blood bubbled from the wound, and even Akos could see, sitting across the room from everyone, that his skin was already starting to close up like a zipper. Everybody got a current gift when they got older, after their bodies changed, which meant, judging by how small Akos still was at 14 seasons old, he wouldn't be getting his for a while yet. Sometimes gifts ran in families, and sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they were useful, and sometimes they weren't. Osnos was useful.
Amazing, Riha said. I can't wait for mine to come. Did you have any idea what it would be?
Osno was the tallest boy in their class, and he stood close to you when he talked to you, so you knew it. The last time he talked to Akos had been a season ago, and Osno's mother had said as she walked away, "For a fate-favored son, he's not much, is he?" Osno had said, "He's nice enough." But Akos wasn't nice. That was just what people said about quiet people. Osno slung his arm over the back of his chair and flicked his dark hair out of his eyes.
My dad says the better you know yourself, the less surprised you'll be by your gift.
Riha's head bobbed in agreement, her braid sliding up and down her back. Akos made a bet with himself that Riha and Osno would be dating by season's end. And then the screen fixed next to the door flickered and switched off. All the lights in the room switched off too, and the ones that glowed under the door in the hallway. Whatever Riha had been about to say froze on her lips. Akos heard a loud voice coming from the hall, and the squeal of his own chair as he scooted back.
Kariseth!
Osno whispered in warning. But Akos wasn't sure what was scary about peeking in the hallway. Not like something was going to jump out and bite him. He opened the door wide enough to let his body through and leaned into the narrow hallway just outside. The building was circular, like a lot of the buildings in Hesse, with teachers' offices in the center, classrooms around the circumference, and a hallway separating the two. When the lights were off, it was so dark in the hall he could see only the emergency lights burning orange at the top of every staircase.
What's happening?
He recognized that voice. It was Ori. She moved into the pool of orange light by the east stairwell. Standing in front of her was her aunt Bada, looking more disheveled than he'd ever seen her. Pieces of hair hanging around her face escaped from its knot, and her sweater buttons done up all wrong. "You are in danger," Bada said. "It is time for us to do as we have practiced."
"Why?" Ori demanded. "You come in here, you drag me out of class, you want me to leave everything, everyone?"
"All the fate-favored are in danger, understand? You are exposed. You must go."
"What about the Karasess? Aren't they in danger too?"
"Not as much as you." Bada grabbed Ori's elbow and steered her toward the landing of the east stairwell. Ori's face was shaded, so Akos couldn't see her expression. But just before she went around the corner, she turned, hair falling across her face, sweater slipping off her shoulder so he could see her collarbone. He was pretty sure her eyes found his then, wide and fearful. But it was hard to say. And then someone called Akos's name. Cece was hustling out of one of the center offices. She was in her heavy gray dress, with black boots, and her mouth was taut.
"Come on," she said. "We've been called to the headmaster's office. Dad is coming for us now. We can wait there."
"What?" Akos began, but as always, he talked too softly for most people to pay attention.
"Come on."
Cece pushed through the door she had just closed. Akos's mind was going in all different directions. Ori was fate-favored. All the lights were off. Their dad was coming to get them. Ori was in danger. He was in danger. Cece led the way down the dark hallway. Then, an open door, a lit lantern, Aija turning toward them. The headmaster sat across from him. Akos didn't know his name, they just called him Headmaster, and saw him only when he was giving an announcement or on his way someplace else. Akos didn't pay him any mind.
"What's going on?"
he asked Aija.
"Nobody will say," Aija said, eyes flicking over to the headmaster. "It is the policy of this school to leave this sort of situation to the parents' discretion," the headmaster said. Sometimes kids joked that the headmaster had machine parts instead of flesh, that if you cut him open, wires would come tumbling out. He talked like it anyway. "And you can't say what sort of situation it is?" I just said to him, in much the way their mom would have if she'd been there. Where is mom, anyway? Akos thought. Their dad was coming for them, but nobody had said anything about their mom.
"Aija," Cece said,
and her whispered voice steadied Akos too. It was almost like she spoke into the hum of the current inside him, leveling it just enough. The spell lasted a while. The headmaster, Aija, Cece, and Akos quiet, waiting.
"It's getting cold," Aija said eventually, and there was a draft creeping under the door, chilling Akos's ankles.
"I know. I had to shut off the power," the headmaster said. "I intend to wait until you are safely on your way before turning it back on."
"You shut off the power for us? Why?"
Cece said sweetly, the same wheedling voice she used when she wanted to stay up later or have an extra candy for dessert. It didn't work on their parents, but the headmaster melted like a candle. Akos half expected there to be a puddle of wax spreading under his desk. "The only way the screens can be turned off during emergency alerts from the assembly," the headmaster said softly, "is if the power is shut down."
"So there was an emergency alert," Cece said, still wheedling.
"Yes. It was issued by the assembly leader just this morning." Aija and Akos traded looks. Cece was smiling, calm, her hands folded over her knees. In this light, with her curly hair framing her face, she was Aus's daughter, pure and simple. Their dad could get what he wanted too, with smiles and laughs, always soothing people, hearts, situations. A heavy fist pounded on the headmaster's door, sparing the waxed man from melting further. Akos knew it was his dad because the doorknob fell out at the last knock, the plate that held it fast to the wood cracking right down the middle. He couldn't control his temper, and his current gift made that pretty clear. Their dad was always fixing things, but half the time it was because he himself had broken them.
"Sorry," Ausa mumbled when he came into the room. He shoved the doorknob back in place and traced the crack with his fingertip. The plate came together a little jagged, but mostly good as new. Their mom insisted he didn't always fix things right, and they had the uneven dinner plates and jagged mug handles to prove it.
"Mr. Kariseth," the headmaster began.
"Thank you, headmaster, for reacting so quickly," their dad said to him. He wasn't smiling even a little. More than the dark hallways, or Ori's shouting aunt, or Sisi's pressed line mouth, his serious face scared Akos. Their dad was always smiling, even when the situation didn't call for it. Their mom called it his very best armor.
"Come on, small child, smaller child, smallest child," Ausa said half-heartedly. "Let's go home."
They were up on their feet and marching toward the school entrance as soon as he said home. They went straight to the coat racks to search the identical gray furballs for the ones with their names stitched into the collars. Kariseth, Kariseth, Kariseth. Sisi and Akos confused theirs for a tick and had to switch. Akos is just a little too small for her arms, hers just a little too long for his short frame. The floater waited just outside, the door still thrown open. It was a little bigger than most, still squat and circular. The dark metal outsides streaked with dirt. The news feed, usually playing in a stream of words around the inside of the floater, wasn't on. The nav screen wasn't on either, so it was just Ausa poking at buttons and levers and controls without the floater telling them what he was doing. They didn't buckle themselves in. Akos felt like it was stupid to waste the time.
"Dad, I just started."
The assembly took it upon itself to announce the fates of the favored lines this morning, the dad said. The oracles shared the fates with the assembly seasons ago, in confidence, as a gesture of trust. Usually a person's fate isn't made public until after they die, known only to them and their families. But now, his eyes raked over each of them in turn. "Now everyone knows your fates."
"What are they?"
Akos asked in a whisper, just as Sisi asked.
"Why is that dangerous?"
Dad answered her, not him.
"It's not dangerous for everyone with a fate, but some are more revealing than others."
Akos thought of Ori's aunt dragging her by the elbow to the stairwell.
"You are exposed. You must go."
Ori had a fate, a dangerous one. But as far as Akos could remember, there wasn't any Rednalis family in the list of favored lines. It must not have been her real name.
"What are our fates?"
Aija asked, and Akos envied him for his loud, clear voice. Sometimes when they stayed up later than they were supposed to, Aija tried to whisper, but one of their parents always ended up at their door to shush them before long. Not like Akos. He kept secrets closer than his own skin, which was why he wasn't telling the others about Ori just yet. The floater zoomed over the ice flower fields their dad managed. They stretched out for miles in every direction, divided by low wire fences. Yellow jealousy flowers, white purities, green harva vines, brown sendis leaves, and last, protected by a cage of wire with current running through it, red hush flower. Before they put up the wire cage, people used to take their lives by running straight into the hushflower fields and dying there among the bright petals, the poison putting them to sleepy death in a few breaths. It didn't seem like a bad way to go, really, Akos thought. Drifting off with flowers all around you and the white sky above,
I'll tell you when we're safe and sound, their dad said, trying to sound cheery.
Where's Mom?
Akko said, and this time Ausa heard him.
Your mother.
Ausa clenched his teeth, and a huge gash opened up in the seat under him, like the top of a loaf of bread splitting in the oven. He swore and ran his hand over it to mend it.
Akos blinked at him, afraid. What had gotten him so angry?
I don't know where your mother is, he finished. I'm sure she's fine.
She didn't warn you about this?
Akko said.
Maybe she didn't know,
Cece whispered. But they all knew how wrong that was. Sifa always, always knew.
Your mother has her reasons for everything she does. Sometimes we don't get to know them,
Ausa said, a little calmer now.
But we have to trust her, even when it's difficult.
Akos wasn't sure their dad believed it. Like maybe he was just saying it to remind himself. Ausa guided the floater down in the front lawn, crushing the tufts and speckled stalks of feathergrass under them. Behind their house, the feathergrass went on as far as Akos could see. Strange things sometimes happened to people in the grasses. They heard whispers, or they saw dark shapes among the stems. They waded through the snow, away from the path, and were swallowed by the earth. Every so often they heard stories about it, or someone spotted a full skeleton from their floater. Living as close to the tall grass as Akos did, he'd gotten used to ignoring the faces that surged toward him from all directions, whispering his name. Sometimes they were crisp enough to identify. Dead grandparents, his mom or dad with warped, corpse faces, kids who were mean to him at school, taunting. But when Akos got out of the floater and reached up to touch the tufts above him, he realized, with a start, that he wasn't seeing or hearing anything anymore. He stopped and hunted the grasses for a sign of the hallucinations anywhere. But there weren't any.
Akos!
Aja hissed. Strange. He chased Aja's heels to the front door. Ausa unlocked it, and they all piled into the foyer to take off their coats. As he breathed the inside air, though, Akos realized something didn't smell right. Their house always smelled spicy, like the breakfast bread their dad liked to make in the colder months. But now it smelled like engine grease and sweat. Akos's insides were a rope, twisting tight.
Dad?
He said as Ausa turned on the lights with the touch of a button. Aja yelled, Cece choked, and Akos went stock still. There were three men standing in their living room. One was tall and slim, one taller and broad, and the third short and thick. All three wore armor that shone in the yellowish, burnstone light, so dark it almost looked black, except it was actually dark, dark blue. They held current blades, the metal clasped in their fists, and the black tendrils of current wrapping around their hands, binding the weapons to them. Akos had seen blades like that before, but only in the hands of the soldiers that patrolled Hessa. They had no need of current blades in their house, the house of a farmer and an oracle. Akos knew it without really knowing it. These men were Shotet, enemies of Thuva, enemies of theirs. People like this were responsible for every candle lit in the memorial of the Shotet invasion. They had scarred Hess's buildings, busted its glass so it showed fractured images. They had culled the bravest, the strongest, the fiercest, and left their families to weeping. Akos's grandmother and her bread knife among them, so said their dad.
What are you doing here? Ausa said, tense.
The living room looked untouched, the cushions still arranged around the low table, the fur blanket curled by the fire where Cece had left it when she was reading. The fire was embers, still glowing, and the air was cold. Their dad took a wider stance, so his body covered all three of them.
No woman,
one of the men said to one of the others. Wonder where she is.
Oracle, one of the others replied. Not an easy one to catch.
I know you speak our language, Ausa said, sterner this time. Stop jabbering away like you don't understand me.
Akos frowned. Hadn't his dad heard them talking about their mom?
He is quite demanding, this one, the tallest one said. He had golden eyes, Akos noticed, like melted metal.
What is the name again?
Ausa, the shortest one said. He had scars all over his face, little slashes going every direction. The skin around the longest one next to his eye was puckered. Their dad's name sounded clumsy in his mouth.
Ausa Karaseth, the golden-eyed one said, and this time he sounded different, like he was suddenly speaking with a thick accent. Only he hadn't had one before, so how could that be?
My name is Vas Kuzar.
I know who you are, Ausa said. I don't live with my head in a hole.
Grab him, the man called Vas said, and the shortest one lunged at their dad.
Sizi and Akos jumped back as their dad and the Shotet soldier scuffled, their arms locked together. Ausa's teeth gritted. The mirror in the living room shattered, the pieces flying everywhere. And then the picture frame on the mantle, the one from their parents' wedding day, cracked in half. But still the Shotet soldier got a hold on Ausa, wrestling him into the living room and leaving the three of them, Aija, Sizi, and Akos, exposed. The shortest soldier forced their dad to his knees and pointed a current blade at his throat.
Make sure the children don't leave, Vas said to the slim one.
Just then Akos remembered the door behind him. He seized the knob, twisted it, but by the time he was pulling it, a rough hand had closed around his shoulder, and the Shotet lifted him up with one arm. Akos's shoulder ached. He kicked the man hard in the leg. The Shotet just laughed.
Little thin-skinned boy, the shoulder spat. You, as well as the rest of your pathetic kind, would do better to surrender now.
We are not pathetic, Akos said.
It was a stupid thing to say, something a little kid said when he didn't know how to win an argument. But for some reason, it stopped everyone in their tracks. Not just the man with his hand clamped around Akos's arm, but Sizi and Aija and Ausa, too.
Everyone stared at Akos, and, damn it all, heat was rushing into his face, the most ill-timed blush he had ever felt in all his life, which was saying something.
Then Vas Kuzar laughed. Your youngest child, I presume, Vas said to Ausa. Did you know he speaks Shotet?
I don't speak Shotet, Akos said weakly.
You just did, Vas said.
So how did the family Karaseth find itself with a Shotet-blooded son, I wonder?
Akos, Aija whispered wonderingly, like he was asking Akos a question.
I do not have Shotet blood,
Akos snapped, and all three of the Shotet soldiers laughed at once. It was only then that Akos heard it. He heard the words coming out of his mouth, with their sure meaning, and he also heard harsh syllables, with sudden stops and closed vowels. He heard Shotet, a language he had never learned. So unlike graceful Thuvazit, which was like wind catching snowflakes in its updraft. He was speaking Shotet. He sounded just like the soldiers. But how? How could he speak a language he had never learned?
Where is your wife, Ausa?
Vas said, turning his attention back to their dad. He turned the current blade in his fist so the black tendrils shifted over his skin.
We could ask her if she had a dalliance with a Shotet man, or if she shares our fine ancestry and never saw fit to tell you about it. Surely the Oracle knows how her youngest son came to be fluent in the revelatory tongue. She's not here, Ausa said, terse.
As you may have observed, the Thuvazit thinks he is clever, Vas said. I think that cleverness with enemies gets a man killed. I'm sure you think many foolish things, Ausa said. And somehow he stared Vas down, despite being on the ground at his feet. Servant of the Noavex, you're like the dirt I remove from under my fingernails. Vas swung at their dad, striking his face so hard he fell to the side. Aija yelled, fighting to get closer, but intercepted by the Shotet who still held Akos's arm. Held both brothers without effort, in fact, like it cost him nothing at all, though Aija at 16 seasons was almost man-size. The low table in the living room cracked right down the middle, from end to end, splitting in half and falling to each side. All the little things that had been on top of it, an old mug, a book, a few scraps of wood from their dad's whittling, scattered across the floor.
If I were you, Vas said low, I would keep that current gift under control, Ausa.
Ausa clutched his face for a tick, and then dove, grabbing the wrist of the short, scarred Shotet soldier standing off to the side and twisting hard, so his grip faltered. Ausa grabbed the blade by the handle and wrenched it free, then turned it back on its owner, his eyebrows raised.
Go ahead and kill him, Vas said. There are dozens more where he came from. But you have a limited number of sons.
Ausa's lip was swollen and bleeding, but he licked the blood away with the tip of his tongue and looked over his shoulder at Vas.
I don't know where she is, Ausa said. You should have checked the temple. This is the last place she would come if she knew you were on your way here.
Vas smiled down at the blade in his hand.
It is just as well, I suppose, he said in Shotet,
looking at the soldier who held Akos with one hand and was pressing Aija to the wall with the other.
Our priority is the child. We know which one is the youngest, the soldier replied in the same language, jerking Akos by the arm again. But which of the other two is the secondborn?
Dad, Akos said desperately. They want to know about the smaller child. They want to know which one of them is younger. The soldier released Akos, but only to swing the back of his hand at him, hitting him right in the cheekbone. Akos stumbled, slamming into the wall, and Sisi choked on a sob, bending over him, her fingers stroking her brother's face. Ausa screamed through his teeth and lunged, plunging the stolen current blade deep into Vas's body, right under the armor. Vas didn't even flinch. He just smiled, crookedly, wrapped his hand around the blade's handle, and tugged the knife free. Ausa was too stunned to stop him. Blood poured from the wound, soaking Vas's dark trousers.
You know my name, but you don't know my gift, Vas said softly. I don't feel pain. Remember?
He grabbed Ausa's elbow again, and pulled his arm out from his side. He plunged the knife into the fleshy part of their dad's arm and dragged down, making him groan like Akos had never heard before. Blood spattered on the floor. Aija screamed again and thrashed, and Sisi's face contorted, but she didn't make a sound. Akos couldn't stand the sight. It had him on his feet, though his face still ached, though there was no purpose to moving and nothing he could do.
Aija, he said quiet. Run. And he threw his body at Vas, meaning to dig his fingers into the wound in the man's side, deeper and deeper until he could tear out his bones, tear out his heart. Scuffling, shouting, sobbing, all the voices combined in Akos's ears, full of horror. He punched uselessly at the armor that covered Vas's side. The blow made his hand throb. The scarred soldier came at him and threw him to the floor like a sack of flour. He put his boot on Akos's face and pressed down. He felt the grit of dirt on his skin.
Dad! Aija was screaming. Dad! Akos couldn't move his head. But when he lifted his eyes, he saw his dad on the ground, halfway between the wall and the doorway, his elbow bent back at a strange angle, blood spread like a halo around his head,
Sisi crouched at Ausa's side.